Let's open our Bibles to Daniel chapter 11. Daniel chapter 11. I was talking to Kurt this week, and he told me that next Sunday I will preach my 450th sermon here at Maranatha. He counted every one of them, and so we're excited to have kind of a milestone. We should hit 500 about this time next year, and so we're looking forward to that. We've barely scratched the surface, so we've got a lot more to cover. We're going to go through Leviticus and Deuteronomy and No, we're not going to do that, but we've got a lot more to cover, so I hope there's at least another 450 in me. Daniel chapter 11 is where we're at this morning. We have come to the final sections of this marvelous book, and we come to chapters 10, 11, and 12, which really contain the final vision of Daniel. We've seen three of these visions already. Daniel chapter 7, 8, and 9 contain the first three visions. Daniel chapters 10, 11, and 12 contain the final vision. It takes three chapters to communicate this final vision of Daniel, and that tells us something about the magnitude of this vision. It takes an entire chapter to introduce it, chapter 10. It takes an entire two chapters to communicate the details of this incredible message from heaven given to us by an angel. We saw this back in chapter 10 of last week, that an angel is dispatched from heaven to give Daniel this final vision. And as we learned last week, this angel is dispatched and is caught up in a spiritual conflict on his way to earth to give Daniel this message. We're given a great glimpse into the spiritual realm and what takes place in the battle between angels and demons. And we get a little peek into that realm, which we normally don't get a glimpse into. And it's there that we see that this angelic messenger was caught up in a battle with the king or the prince of the kingdom of Persia. It was a demon assigned to the area of Persia by Satan himself for the purpose of oppressing God's people and attempting to annihilate them. And that tells us something about the nature of this vision. It is about the coming persecution and oppression that will come upon the Jewish people, which we know to take place from the time of Daniel until the return of Jesus Christ. It is this message that this angel is sent to deliver. After 21 days of conflict with this demon, he is victorious with the help of Michael the archangel. And he comes to Daniel and he delivers to Daniel this incredible message about a great conflict. A great conflict that will affect the people of God, the Israelites, the Jewish people. And it is about the coming persecution and suffering that they will experience at the hand of Gentile rulers. If you look back in chapter 10, verse 14, the angel says to Daniel, "Now I have come to give you an understanding of what will happen to your people in the latter days, for the vision pertains to the days yet future." That's the context of this vision. It is a description of the latter days, a description of the final events that will affect the nation of Israel, and it really gives us a span of history from the time of Daniel all the way to the return of Christ, and in between, which is now at least 2,500 years, immense persecution for the Israelites. A vision that's going to encompass a number of years. And during those years, Israel will experience a punishment given to them by God for their rebellion and for their disobedience. And it must have been very difficult for Daniel to hear this because he was thinking the 70 years of tribulation in Babylon are over. And yet God comes and says, "No, Daniel, before it gets better, it's going to get worse. And you as a nation are going to have to experience much suffering and oppression." As we come to chapter 11 this morning, we come to the final details of this vision. We come to the actual details of this vision, and we're told specifically what's going to take place from Daniel to the return of Jesus Christ. It has been said that this chapter is the most detailed prophetic revelation in the book of Daniel. And I would argue that this chapter is perhaps the most detailed prophetic revelation in the entire Bible. It is so specific that scholars, both ancient and modern, have said that there's no way this book could have been written before these events because it's so specific. And so some scholars have actually taken the position that Daniel was given this vision and wrote this book after the fact. But it was written in about 200 BC rather than 500 or 600 BC. In fact, there was a philosopher I was reading about this week by the name of Porphyry, who in the 3rd century AD wrote a treatise on the fact that this could not have happened, could not have occurred prior to these events because it's too specific. And no one has the capacity to know with such specificity. Thank you. These events. I would agree. It's impossible for anyone except God, who knows all things and who is entirely omniscient and who has planned all the details of human history. Because that's what Isaiah tells us. Isaiah 46:10, he says this, "I am God and there is no other. I am God and there is none like me, declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times things which have not been done, saying my purpose will be established and I will accomplish all my good pleasure." God says, "I have declared the end from the beginning. The end's already been determined because I've declared it before the foundation of the world. If there's anyone in the world who's able to tell us beforehand the specific events of human history, God is, because he's already ordained it." This prophecy is really about the omniscience of God. And it shows us that he has truly ordained all that comes to pass. And as we walk through the details of this prophecy this morning, I want you to remember that. I want you to remember that this is a statement and a demonstration of the absolute transcendent omniscience of God. Here's what we're going to do this morning. Today is a history lesson. Today is a history lesson. And at this point, I want you to put your pencils down and your pens down. And I don't want you to take any notes. Normally, I don't say that. Normally, I tell you I want you to take notes because I want you to remember what we're talking about. I want you to review those notes, and I want you to go back and study those notes. Today, I don't want you to do that. Here's why. I'm going to give you so many details today, you can't write them all down. It's going to be impossible. There's no way for you to be able to write down everything that's in these verses. There are so many specifics, so many people, so many details, so many nuances to this prophecy that, let me just tell you up front, you're not going to get it all. So I want you to listen, and I want you to come away with a profound sense of the transcendent omniscience of God. And I want you to leave this morning saying, "Wow, we have a great God who has already ordained all the details of human history," and you leave with a profound sense of that omniscience. Listen, God knows what's happening. God knows what's happening in human history. He knows what's going on with ISIS. He knows what's going on with the nations of the world and the kings of the world and the rulers of the world. He knows what's going on in our country. He knows what's going on at the upper levels of our government. He knows. And he knows what's taking place in our church. And he knows what's taking place in your life because he's ordained all those specific details. And as we come to chapter 11 this morning, we're going to look at verses 1 to 35. And we're going to look at these specific details given before any of them ever took place, predictions which reveal to the Jewish people what will take place in their history and how it will culminate in the return of Jesus Christ. It's going to take us today and the next two Sundays to work through this. But I want to show you this morning 4 predictions. We'll put some outlines up there if you want to follow along, but just listen. Predictions, 4 predictions. Prediction number 1 are predictions about the kings of Medo-Persia. Predictions about the kings of Medo-Persia. You're going to need to put your history hats on. And I hope you find this interesting. I know perhaps some of you this morning are saying, I'm not a history buff. That's okay. But I want you to see how secular history intersects with biblical history and the God of both of those. Number 1, predictions about the kings of Medo-Persia. Verse number 1 says, "In the first year of Darius the Mede, I rose to be an encouragement and a protection for him." This is the angel speaking to Daniel, giving him the vision. He's about ready to tell him the contents. He first sets the stage. He says, "In the first year of Darius the Mede, I arose to be an encouragement and a protection for him." Now, we're not exactly entirely sure who the him is. It could refer to Darius, who Daniel is told that the angel came to be a protection for, or it could refer to Michael the archangel. If you look in the last verse of chapter 10, that's a reference to Michael the prince, the archangel. So it's very possible that the angel is saying, "I've come and I arose to be an encouragement and a protection for him," for Michael the prince, the archangel. If that's the case, then this is a description of how angels work together. We saw in chapter 10 how the angel came and was caught up in a battle with Satan's demon over the area of Persia, and Michael came to assist him in that battle. And here we're told that that same angel, if the reference is to Michael, went then at some point in the past to assist Michael. There's a mutuality, there's a cooperation between the angels as they work together. And this angel says, "I arose to be an encouragement and a protection for Michael." There's a mutuality and a cooperation amongst the angelic realm in their efforts to thwart Satan and his minions. With that background, then starting in verse 2, we are beginning to be told the contents of this vision. Look at verse 2. He says, "And now I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings are going to arise in Persia. Then a fourth will gain more riches than all of them. And as soon as he becomes strong through his riches, he will arouse the whole empire against the realm of Greece." The angel comes to Daniel and says, okay, this is where it all starts. After Cyrus, there's going to be four kings. Three kings followed by a fourth king. And that fourth king will be characterized by many riches. We know from Persian history that this is exactly what happened. Cyrus died in 529 BC, and after him there was a succession of three kings, followed by a fourth king who was very rich. Now listen, there's no question about this. You say, how do you know all this? Because Persian history is very well documented, and you can go and read and study and see that exactly the details of these visions line up with the prophetic history and the actual history of Persia itself. So who are these kings? First king, number one, after Cyrus, is Cambyses. He was the son of Cyrus. He ruled from 530 to 522 BC. So as soon as Cyrus went off the throne, Cambyses, his son, stepped up. He was the first of the three. Second was another one called Pseudosmerdis. He ruled for just a short time, for 1 year, in 521 and 522 BC. He usurped the throne. He was not in line for the throne. He usurped it, and because of that, his time on the throne was very short. He is the second king. The third king is a man by the name of Darius I Hystaspes. He ruled from 522 to 586 BC. We know from Persian history that those were the first three kings in succession after Cyrus himself. Verse 2 tells us that there will be a fourth. One who will gain far more riches than all of them, and as soon as he becomes strong through his riches, he will arouse the whole empire against Greece. Now we know exactly who this is, because the fourth king after Cyrus is a man by the name of Xerxes, also known as Ahasuerus. If you've studied Esther before, he is the king in the book of Esther. He is the king who set up the beauty pageant for Queen Esther to be chosen and become queen in place of Vashti. That's the king. That's the same man here. He is the fourth king, and he is rich. He's amassed a great amount of wealth, and he's done so by inheriting it from the previous kings who won it in battles. And so he has gathered together a massive amount of riches, and because of that, he's been able to assemble a massive army. And it says here that as soon as he became strong through his riches, he will arouse the whole empire against the realm of Greece. And that's exactly what happened. You're going to get sick of me saying that. That's what happened. In 490 BC, this man's father, Xerxes' father, went to battle against Greece. He was soundly defeated by Greece. That left a bad taste in his mouth. So 10 years later, in 480 BC, Xerxes, with his large amount of wealth, pulled together this massive army and went to battle against Greece. He also was soundly defeated. Went back with his tail between his legs, and Greece would not forget. It took 150 years for Greece to become a superpower, but over the course of those years, they would not forget what Xerxes did in attacking them, and they would retaliate in the form of a man named Alexander the Great. Prediction number two. Predictions about Alexander the Great, because he is told to us in verse 3. It says, "And a mighty king will arise, and he will rule with great authority and do as he pleases." Now keep in mind, this is all prophetic. This has not happened. None of this has taken place. And by the time we get to Alexander, it is 200 years after this prophecy has been given. This is all prophetic. We're at the point of 200 years before these events occurred, and God is telling Daniel through the angel that this is taking place. A mighty king will arise. Who is that? That's Alexander. He's the ruler of Greece. We've talked about him a number of times in chapter 7 and in chapter 8. He is the man who was given rulership by his father, Philip V of Macedon. He was an intelligent man being schooled by Aristotle, and he was an incredible military commander being trained in military strategy by his father, Philip. Between 334 and 330 BC, he conquered Medo-Persia, Asia Minor, Syria, and Egypt, even as far as India, and he did it with great speed. He rose to power at the age of 21. By the time he died in age 33, he had conquered the entire world. Never suffered a defeat, and by age 33, wept because he had conquered every enemy. He died at age 33 of malaria with complications from an alcohol-induced party. And he died 323 AD, BC. Verse 4 tells us what happens or would happen as soon as that happened. Look at verse 4. But as soon as he has arisen, his kingdom will be broken up and parceled out toward the four points of the compass, though not to his own descendants, nor according to his authority which he wielded, for his sovereignty will be uprooted and given to others beside him. That's exactly what happened. Alexander died at the height of his career as soon as he had arisen. His kingdom was then broken up and parceled out to the four points of the compass. And we know that it took about 20 years after his death, but in the course of those 20 years, four generals arose to take control over the kingdom of Greece. They are Ptolemy, Seleucus, Cassander, and Lysimachus. Those will be on the quiz. Make sure you know those. Ptolemy, the first general, ruled over the area of Egypt. Seleucus ruled over the area of Syria. Cassander ruled over the area of Macedonia and Greece. And Lysimachus was the ruler over Thrace and Asia Minor. Now, of those four, I want you to remember two. I want you to remember Ptolemy, the king of Egypt, and I want you to remember Seleucus, the king of Syria, because the rest of the scripture of this passage deals with the king of the north and the king of the south. And you need to know who those are. The king of the south is Ptolemy and his descendants, and the king of the north is Seleucus and his descendants. So we're going to flesh that out for the rest of this passage. I want you to notice in verse 4 that it was prophesied that none of Alexander's descendants would ascend to the throne, and that's exactly what happened. Look at verse 4. Not to his own descendants, which means none of his descendants would arise to the throne, and none of them did. He had a half-brother by the name of Philip Arrhidas. He was a mentally deficient man, and he was murdered in 317 BC. Alexander had a son, and his son's name was Alexander. It was born to him after he died, and he was murdered in 310 BC. He also had an illegitimate son by the name of Hercules, who was murdered in 309 BC. He had a half-brother and two sons. None of them ascended to the throne in exact fulfillment of this prophecy. So his descendants would not ascend to the throne. Notice, too, that verse 4 says, nor would his authority extend, would the kingdom have the same authority as he had. Verse 4 says, nor according to his authority which he wielded, which means the empire would never recover to the same level of power that it had under Alexander. And that's exactly what happened. The four generals were never able to bring the empire back to the same level of power as Alexander had. Prediction number 3. Predictions about the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. Now remember I told you need to remember the first two? This is where it comes into play. Predictions about the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. And starting in verse 5 through verse 19, we have an entire section devoted to the kings that represent the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. Now remember what we just said. Ptolemy was one of the generals who assumed control over Egypt, and Seleucid was one of the generals who assumed power over Syria. And these two areas of the Grecian Empire were going to spend the next couple hundred years battling with one another. Conflict, after suffering, after all kinds of war between these two parts or sectors of the Grecian Empire. And the reason that this is included here, the reason you don't hear about the other two is because who was between the northern and the southern area? Israel. the king of the north in Syria, the king of the south in Egypt. And if you draw a line between them, you have to cross through Israel to get them. So all of these future conflicts that are going to take place between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids, most of them involve conflict in the land of Israel, which is the point of this entire vision, that God's people, the Israelites, were going to suffer conflict and persecution and oppression at the hands of the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. And that's where the prophecy gets very specific. Are you still with me? Verse 5. Then the king of the south will grow strong, along with one of his princes, who will gain ascendancy over him and obtain dominion, and his dominion will be a great dominion indeed. So we hear here about the king of the south. This is Ptolemy. This is one of the generals who was given control over the Egyptian region. He is the king of the south. He grew strong. His name was Ptolemy the First Soter. He ruled from 323 to 285 BC. And it says in verse 5 that along with one of his princes who will gain ascendancy, there was a man who came up under Ptolemy, and his name was Seleucus. He actually started out under Ptolemy's reign in Egypt. He went out from under Ptolemy. He conquered some lands. Then he was attacked by another group who then needed help from Ptolemy. So Seleucus comes to Ptolemy and says, "Hey, I need some help." And so Ptolemy assists him in his battles. At some point, though, they part ways. And Seleucus goes to be the king in the northern region of Syria. He is the king of the north. And the result of this is that his empire, the northern empire, actually grew to be more powerful than the southern part of the Grecian empire. And that's exactly what verse 5 says, that along with one of the princes who will gain ascendancy over him. So the king of the north will actually gain ascendancy over the king of the south, and that's exactly what happened. The south started out more powerful under Ptolemy, but in a short time, the north became more powerful under Seleucus. And you can see now the seeds of conflict being sown. King of the north, king of the south, and there's going to be battles between them. Eventually, though, they realize the tension that exists between them should not exist. They try and offer some peace. There tries to be a kind of an attempt at a peace accord between them, and it's a reference in verse 6. After some years, they, meaning the king of the north and the king of the south, will form an alliance, and the daughter of the king of the south will come to the king of the north to carry out a peaceful arrangement. But she will not retain her position of power, nor will he remain with his power, but she will be given up along with those who brought her in and the one who sired her, as well as he who supported her in those times. Clear? Let me explain. The king of the south, Ptolemy the First, and the king of the north, Seleucus, die, and they have successors on their throne. So Ptolemy I died in 285 BC, and his son, Ptolemy the Second, Philadelphus, became the king of the south. Seleucus was murdered in 281 BC, and his son, Antiochus the First, then ascended to power. He died after a short time, and his son, Seleucus's grandson, Antiochus II, Theos, ruled in Syria from 262 to 246. So now you have two other men on the throne. Starts out with Ptolemy and Seleucus. They die. They have descendants. So on the throne in the north, you have Antiochus II. And on the throne in the south, you have Ptolemy II. And they were bitter enemies. They fought conflicts. But in 250 BC, they entered into an alliance. Look at verse 6 says, they wanted to form an alliance and work out a peaceful arrangement. And so in that day, if you were going to arrange a peaceful arrangement between nations, you did it through marriage. And that's exactly what verse 6 says. It says, the daughter of the king of the south will come to the king of the north to carry out a peaceful arrangement. That's exactly what happened. The king of the south had a daughter. And her name was Bernice. And he said, if we're going to get peace with the king of the north, we're going to have to work out some political arrangement, and we'll do that through marriage. And so the king of the south, Ptolemy II, gave his daughter Bernice to the king of the north, who was Antiochus II, and she was given to him in marriage for political purposes. The problem is, Antiochus II was married. And so he had a problem on his hands. And so he decided to divorce his wife. Her name was Laodice, and he divorced her. He married the daughter of the king of the south. Her name was Bernice, as I said. And that's exactly what happened. They went through with the marriage. But notice what happens in verse 6. She will not retain her position of power, nor will he remain with his power, but she will be given up along with those who brought her in and the one who sired her, as well as he who supported her in those times. That's what happened. It didn't last. Marriage didn't last. Because he had a scorned wife, Laodice, who had just been divorced by Antiochus II, didn't really appreciate that. And so she took matters into her own hands, and she took revenge, and she took revenge by having Bernice and their infant son killed, and then she had Antiochus, her former husband, poisoned. Sounds like a little bit out of a soap opera, doesn't it? That's exactly what took place. This is 200 years before it ever happened. How could anyone know about a scorned wife and a daughter of a king who's given in marriage and them all, her killing them? And that's exactly what happened. And so Laodice makes her son, Seleucus II, whose name was Callinicus, king of the north. Do you see why you're not taking any notes this morning? So here's what you have. Bernice is dead. She's been killed by the scorned wife of the king of the north. And you can imagine that didn't sit very well with Bernice's family, the king of the south. They hear about this. She's been murdered. Their infant son was murdered. And so the family sets out to avenge the death of Bernice, which, by the way, was prophesied in verse 7. Look at it. But one of the descendants of her line will arise in his place, and he will come against their army and enter the fortress of the king of the north, and he will deal with them and display great strength. That's exactly what happened. It says in verse 7 that one of her descendants, one in her line, and by the way, she had a brother, Bernice did. His name was Ptolemy III Euergetes. He succeeded his father, Ptolemy II Philadelphus, as king of the south. And he heard what had happened to his sister, Bernice, in Syria. And he says, this is not going to stand. And so he launches an attack against the king of the north. He had actually hoped to arrive in time to save her life because he heard things were going south quickly, but he got there not in time. He found his sister was dead, so he killed Laodice, the divorced wife of Antiochus, the former king of the north who killed his sister. And it says in verse 8 that he would take all the treasure back to Egypt. It was exactly what happened. Look at verse 8. It says, also their gods with their metal images and their precious vessels of silver and gold he will take into captivity to Egypt, and he on his part will refrain from attacking the king of the north for some years. That's exactly what he did. History tells us that he took back 40,000 talents of silver, 2,400 pieces of gold vessels, and many Egyptian idols. Remember we said that when a king went into another land, they would often pillage the temple and take back all their treasures in order to prove that their god was stronger than the other god. That's what he did. And he went back to Egypt, and he begins handing out these talents of silver and these gold vessels. And that's why his name is called Ptolemy II Euergetes. Ptolemy III Euergetes, which means benefactor. He gave the people the spoils of war. And he became known as the benefactor to his people. Verse 9. What happens next? It says, then the latter being the king of the north, will enter the realm of the king of the south, but will return to his own land. So here's a prophecy that the king of the north would actually go and wage war against the king of the south, but will return to his own land. And that's exactly what happened. After this humiliating defeat, Seleucus II, Callinicus, the son of Laodice, the king of the north, now sought to invade Egypt, and he didn't like the idea of the south winning, and so he goes to battle against the king of the south. He was beaten soundly, and he comes back to Syria in a weakened condition. Look what it says in verse 9. He will return to his own land. The reason he had to return to his own land is because he was beaten by the king of the south. Verse 10, though, tells us that his sons will mobilize and assemble a great multitude of great forces, and one of them will keep on coming and overflow and pass through, that he may again wage war up to his very fortress. And history tells us that's exactly what happened. Seleucus II Callinicus had two sons, and their names were Seleucus III and Antiochus III, also known as the Great. He had two sons, and those two sons kind of took up their father's banner, and they did what their father couldn't do. They mounted several campaigns against Egypt. And so one son, Seleucus III, goes out and attacks Asia Minor, has victory there, but is actually defeated after some time and is killed. He dies in battle in Asia Minor in 223 BC. Now look at verse 10, because there's a transition in verse 10 that says, his sons, plural, will mobilize and assemble a great multitude of forces, which is what they did. Look at the next phrase. And one of them, singular, will keep on coming and overthrow. That's exactly what happened. The younger son, Seleucus III, is killed in Asia Minor. That's the older son. The younger son, Antiochus III, the Great, was successful in battle and begins marching against Egypt. And he battled all the way to Egypt against the ruler of Egypt at this time, who was Ptolemy Philopater. And he restored Syria back down as far as Gaza, which is in almost in Israel today. So here's a man, Antiochus the Great, and really the next section of verses deals entirely with this man, Antiochus the Great. He became king at age 18, ruled over Syria from 223 to 187 BC. And he mounted multiple campaigns as king of the north against Egypt and was highly successful. And verse 10 tells us exactly that would take place, that he would overflow and he would pass through a large amount of land. That's what he did. He conquered many parts of Egypt. Well, put yourself in the shoes of the king of Egypt. That's not going to sit well. And so here's another conflict that enrages because of these attacks by the king of the north. So look at verse 11. It says, the king of the south will be enraged, and he was, and go forth and fight with the king of the north, and the latter will raise a great multitude, but that multitude will be given into the hand of the former. So the king of Egypt at this point is the man named Ptolemy Philopater. He didn't like the Syrian army coming so close to this border, so he assembled a large army to fight against Antiochus the Great. There's something interesting about this man, this king of Egypt, though. He's a lazy man. History tells us he is very lazy. He is indolent. He wants a life of ease and luxury. And so he's not very interested in battle. But in this case, he actually assembles the war machine. He pulls the army together, and he goes to fight against Antiochus the Great, the king of the north. He goes with his sister wife, whose name was Arsinoe. And they go and attack Antiochus the Great, the king of the north. History tells us exactly how this happened. Ptolemy, the king of the south, had 70,000 foot soldiers, 5,000 cavalry, and 73 elephants. And the king of the north, Antiochus, had 62,000 foot soldiers, 6,000 cavalry, and 102 elephants. Does it say who would win? Look at verse 11. Of course it does. It says the king of the south, king of Egypt, would win. Verse 11, the latter will raise a great multitude, but that multitude will be given into the hand of the former. So the king of the north, Antiochus, would be defeated by Egypt, and his army would be given into the hand of the Egyptians. And guess what? That's exactly what happened. Ptolemy slaughtered many thousands of the Syrian army. Exactly what verse 12 says. Look at verse 12. It says, when the multitude is carried away, his heart will be lifted up, and he will cause tens of thousands to fall, yet he will not prevail. That's exactly what happened. Ptolemy, king of the south, won this battle, and history tells us that he killed 10,000 foot soldiers, 300 cavalry, and 5 elephants. You can't make this stuff up, people. This is history. And at this point, it's prophesied 300 years before any of this takes place. Unfortunately for Ptolemy, though, his victory would be short-lived. He goes back to Egypt, having conquered the king of the north. He goes back to Egypt, and he goes back to his lazy, luxurious lifestyle. And Antiochus, the man who he had just attacked and won victory over, begins to kind of pull himself back together. Look at verse 13. For the king of the north will again raise a greater multitude than the former, and after an interval of some years, he will press on with great an army and much equipment. So Antiochus is beaten. He spends the next 13 or 14 years regrouping, kind of rebuilding his army, rebuilding his, after his losses, assembling a well-equipped army. See the end of verse 13? He says he assembled himself with much equipment. Verses 13 to 16 then describe how Antiochus launched a series of attacks against Egypt. Now, by this time, Ptolemy Philopater, the king of the south, has died. And his son, Ptolemy V, Epiphanes, has risen to power. So you have a different king on the throne in Egypt at this point. But Antiochus goes up against the king of the south. Look at verse 14. Now, in those times, many will rise up against the king of the south. The violent ones among your people will also lift themselves up in order to fulfill the vision, but they will fall down. Daniel is told by the angel that there will be other people who join the king of the north in their battle against the king of the south. Many others will rise up against this king. And also look at verse 14. It says, the violent ones among your people. What is that reference to? The angel is talking to Daniel. And he says to Daniel, amongst your people, there are going to be violent ones who arise and they attach themselves to one of these armies in the hopes of gaining victory and gaining their independence. That's what the violent ones among your people refer to. It referred to Jews who were sick and tired of the conflict in their land and the fighting between the north and the south. And so some of them, some of the more violent Jews, want their independence from Egypt. And so they side with the king of the north, hoping that he's going to destroy the king of the south and Egypt and then give them back their land. But verse 14 at the end says, unfortunately, they will fall down. And that's exactly what happened. A number of Jews rose up with the king of the north to go to battle against the king of the south, but they were defeated, and they never did fully achieve the independence that they were looking for. It took some time, but that's what happened. But in verse 15, look at what happens in the meantime. Then the king of the north will come. He will cast up a siege ramp and capture a well-fortified city, and the forces of the south will not stand their ground, not even their choicest troops, for there will be no strength to stand. So the king of the north, Antiochus the Great, conquers the Egyptian army at a city called Peneus. And he takes control of that entire region. Now, Ptolemy had sent a general to kind of represent Egypt and try and win back the land from the king of the north. His name was Scopas, General Scopas. And he was sent by the king Ptolemy to try and hold the land for Egypt, specifically the land of Palestine. But Scopas was defeated by Antiochus. And as he was defeated by Antiochus, he actually ran away, he fled, and he hid himself in a city called Sidon. He holed himself up in there. Well, Antiochus chases him down. That's what verse 15 says. The king of the north will come and cast up a siege ramp and capture a well-fortified city. That well-fortified city was Sidon. And so Antiochus pursues him all the way to the city of Sidon, chases him down, builds a siege ramp against that city, and Scopas is forced to surrender because him and his army could not stand up against Antiochus. And that's exactly what verse 15 says would happen. Verse 16. But he who comes against him will do as he pleases, and no one will be able to withstand him. He will also stay for a time in the beautiful land with destruction in his hand. That means Antiochus would be completely successful in his campaigns against Ptolemy, against Egypt. And he would stay for a while in the beautiful land. That's a reference to Israel. And as he's staying there in the land of Israel, he's wreaking some havoc in the land. Now this ties into the point of this vision. Israel is going to suffer. They're going to be oppressed and persecuted by their enemies. And so Antiochus takes control of Palestine. He then decides in verse 17 to strengthen his power, and he realizes he needs to keep Egypt on his side. So the people he's been battling against all this time, he realizes there probably should be a peaceful arrangement here, some sort of treaty with these people to preserve the peace. So he tries to get them on his side. Verse 17 says he would do something very interesting. He will set his face to come with the power of his whole kingdom, bringing with him a proposal of peace, which he will put into effect, and he will also give him the daughter of women to ruin it, but she will not take a stand for him or be on his side. This is interesting. Antiochus the Great has a daughter by the name of Cleopatra. Heard of her? And so Antiochus the Great thinks, well, maybe I need to have peace with Egypt, and so I'm going to give my daughter, much like was done previously in these political arranged marriages, he gives his daughter Cleopatra to marry the king of Egypt, who is Ptolemy V Epiphanes at this point. It was a marriage for political purposes, and Antiochus was at war with Rome at this point, and he realizes that if Egypt joins Rome against him, he's going to be defeated. So he tries to get the king of Egypt on his side so they won't side with Rome, so that he's not attacked. So in order to preserve that and keep the Romans away from him, he actually gives his daughter Cleopatra to the king of the south, and an agreement was made for her to marry him. Problem is, at this point, he's only 10. A little young for marriage. So the arrangement is made, and they wait for 4 years until he's 14, and in the year 197, Cleopatra marries Ptolemy V Epiphanes. Now, he did it with the ruse of preserving peace with Egypt, but I want you to see that in verse 17, it says he also did this to give the daughter of women to ruin it. Here's what he wanted. He wanted a spy in Egypt. He wanted someone inside Egypt so he would kind of know what was going on. So he thinks his daughter, Cleopatra, would be able and willing to go there to infiltrate the Egyptian government by marriage and neutralize any alliance between Egypt and Rome. He sends her ultimately to ruin that alliance between Egypt and Rome and have an informant on the inside. Problem is, the whole thing backfired. Because verse 17 says it was. Would. Look at verse 17. But she will not take a stand for him or be on his side. Cleopatra chose her husband over her father. And so as she's sent and she's married to Ptolemy V Epiphanes, she actually decides she's more attached to her Egyptian husband than her father. The whole plan boomerangs and falls apart. So dads, if you're thinking about arranging marriages, maybe not a good idea. Can come back to haunt you. You say, what is the point of all of this? Are you serious? You're going to keep going through all of this? Friends, listen, I want you to understand that every single detail of human history is laid down by the God of the universe in his divine omniscience, and he's ordained everything that's taking place. There's more. Verse 18. Then he will turn his face to the coastlands and capture many, but a commander will put a stop to his scorn against him. Moreover, he will repay him for his scorn. So Antiochus the Great kind of goes all these battles. He goes and gets victory over all the parts of the many parts of the world, and he decides to go to the coastlands, verse 18 says, and to capture many. So he sets his sights on Greece and the area around the Mediterranean Sea. He goes to battle there, but the problem is it wouldn't happen for him. A commander will put a stop to his scorn against him. Verse 18 says that. And that's exactly what happened. Rome begins to feel threatened by Antiochus the Great. And so he sees that they need to stop this guy. Otherwise, he's going to take over the world. And so Rome sends a commander. His name was Lucius Cornelius Scipio, or also known as Scipio Asiaticus. He was the brother of the more famous Scipio Africanus. Have you heard of him? Scipio Africanus was one who defeated Hannibal and the Carthaginians. His brother, the less famous one, Scipio Asiaticus, is the one who sent, the commander who is sent to stop Antiochus the Great. And that's exactly what he did. He stopped him. He defeated Antiochus at Thermopylae in 191 BC, and the following year he defeated him at Magnesia, which is near Ephesus, in direct fulfillment of verse 18. Verse 19, what does Antiochus do? He will turn his face toward the fortress of his own land, but he will stumble and fall and be found no more. He returns to his land, the land of Syria, in 188 BC. He's defeated there. He tries to pillage a temple to Zeus, because now there's been war reparations placed on him by Rome. He needs to pay. He needs to pay money to Rome for all the damage that he's caused in all of these battles. And so he tries to pillage a temple in Elymais because he needed money to repay these costs. He was killed by a mob that was defending the temple. He probably would have gone down in history as one of the greatest generals who lived if he hadn't attacked Greece and the area around the Mediterranean. That's the predictions about the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. You say, why is that important? It's important because in verse 20, it sets up the coming of the next one. Look at verse 20. Antiochus the Great was followed by one named Seleucus the Fourth Philopater. He's described in verse 20. Then in his place, in the place of Antiochus the Great, will be one who arose, who will send an oppressor through the jewel of his kingdom, yet within a few days he will be shattered, though not in anger, nor in battle. Antiochus the Great was followed by his son, Seleucus the Fourth Philopater. And he, also under the same charge to raise money to pay Rome for the war reparations, begins to collect taxes. Do you see the word in verse 20 where it says oppressor? He will send an oppressor through the jewel of the kingdom. That word oppressor is the word exactor of tribute, or one who collects taxes. And so what this son of Antiochus the Great did, he goes out and he raises taxes because he's got this big bill that he has to pay to Rome. So he starts raising taxes. The NIV says his successor will send out a tax collector to maintain the royal splendor. And that's exactly what happened. His name was Heliodorus. He's the tax collector who has begun to collect taxes on behalf of Seleucus Philopater. But verse 20 says what happens. Within a few days, he, the king, Philopater, will be shattered, though not in anger nor in battle. The king would not die in battle. He would not die as others died. It says he would die not in anger nor in battle. And that's exactly what happened. Heliodorus, his treasurer, who was sent to collect taxes, poisoned him because he wanted the throne for himself. Exactly how God said it would happen. The stage is now set for one more individual. Prediction number 4. Predictions about Antiochus Epiphanes. Take a breath. Take a deep breath. Here we go. Last section. Predictions about Antiochus Epiphanes. This is what the messenger from heaven has been doing. He has been setting the stage for this individual. And if you remember, back in chapter 8, when we went through that 8th chapter, we said that there was a man by the name of Antiochus Epiphanes who was a major player in Jewish history. And he was a major persecutor of the Jewish people. He was a major oppressor of the Jewish people. He has gone down in history as a Hitler-like individual who wreaked havoc upon the Jewish nation. He is really the Antichrist of the Old Testament. He is the one who came in the type of Antichrist, and everything that he did typified what the future Antichrist is going to do against the nation of Israel in that period of time known as the Great Tribulation. And so what you have described in verses 20 or 21 to 35 is a description of Antiochus Epiphanes, the one who wreaked havoc upon the nation of Israel. He gave himself the name Epiphanes, which means the illustrious one. When his enemies thought he should have been named Antiochus Epimenes, the madman. That's really what he was. He was a crazed, wicked, vile man who took out all kinds of atrocities against the Jewish people. And it's all prophesied right here in Daniel 11. Look at verse 21. In his place, meaning in the place of Seleucus the Fourth Philopater, in his place, a despicable person will arise. What a great description. Wouldn't you like that description for yourself? A despicable person would arise on whom the honor of kingship has not been conferred, but he will come in a time of tranquility and seize the kingdom by intrigue. And the word intrigue there literally means slippery places. He would use slippery actions, slippery deceit to worm his way to the throne because he was not the rightful heir to the throne. You see, his brother, Seleucus Philopater, the one who was murdered, who was poisoned by Heliodorus, had a son, and his son was named Demetrius, but Demetrius was held in hostage in Rome. There was no way for him to get to Syria to step onto the throne. And so Antiochus Epiphanes, when he hears his brother is murdered, seizes the opportunity to travel to Syria to be king and proclaim himself as king. He arranged himself on the throne by intrigue. Verse 22. The overflowing forces will be flooded away before him and shattered, and also the prince of the covenant. He will destroy his enemies, particularly Egypt, and he will go against the prince of the covenant, which is probably a reference to Onias, who was the high priest in Jerusalem, whom he had murdered. Verse 23, after an alliance is made with him, he will practice deception, and he will go up and gain power with a small force of people. That is exactly what he did. He developed an alliance with the king of Egypt, who at this point is Ptolemy the VI Philometor, and he deceived him. And he used that as an opportunity to gain power, and he launched a series of wars against Egypt and took town after town after town, conquering his way through Egypt until it was completely in his power. Verse 24, in a time of tranquility, he will enter the richest parts of the realms, and he will accomplish what his fathers never did, nor his ancestors. He will distribute plunder and booty and possessions among them, and he will devise his schemes against strongholds, but only for a time. He went into the richest, most productive parts of Egypt. He stole from the rich people, and he began, in a way to try and build his power base, redistribute that wealth within the country, like Robin Hood. And he did that for a very strategic purpose. He sought to build his favor among the poor people in Egypt, to win them over to himself, and that's exactly what he did. Verse 25 says, he will stir up his strength and courage against the king of the south with a large army, so the king of the south will mobilize an extremely large and mighty army for war, but he will not stand, for schemes will be devised against him. So Antiochus Epiphanes launched another war against Egypt. He attacked Ptolemy Philometor. Antiochus conquered him because he was betrayed from the inside. Look at the end of verse 25. It says, schemes will be devised against him. Ptolemy's own people betrayed him to Antiochus Epiphanes. Verse 26 says the same thing. Those who eat his choice food, those who eat the choice food with the king will destroy him, and his army will overflow, but many will fall down slain. Ptolemy Philometor was betrayed by his closest confidants, and Antiochus and the invading Syrian army took him over. Verse 27, as for both kings, their hearts will be intent on evil. They will speak lies to each other at the same table, but it will not succeed, for the end is still to come at the appointed time. History tells us that Antiochus Epiphanes and Ptolemy Philometor sat down at a table to try and work it out, to try and build peace with one another, but they lied. They both lied to each other, and that's exactly what it says. They will speak lies to each other at the same table, and it won't succeed. So any type of peaceful arrangement that they had tried to build was not done, because they had both crossed their fingers behind their backs. Verse 28, he will return to his land with much plunder, but his heart will be set against the holy covenant. He will take action and then return to his own land. He will return to his land and will set his heart against the holy covenant. That's Israel. That's the Jewish people. So after his campaign in Egypt, Antiochus Epiphanes travels back up to Syria, and on his way to Syria, he stops in Israel, and he desecrates the land. He absolutely destroys them. He attacks their city, the city of Jerusalem. He slaughters all kinds of people in Jerusalem. History tells us he killed 80,000 Jewish men, women, and children. He took 40,000 Jewish prisoners and sold that many into slavery as well, and robbed the temple of its gold and its silver. You see how this fits in with God's explanation to Israel that they're going to suffer? It's exactly what took place. This man was wicked, vile. He subjugated the people and the land to himself. He interrupted their worship. He destroyed their sacrificial system. And he demanded the authority and the worship from the people of Israel. Verse 29, at the appointed time, you will return and come into the south, but this last time it will not turn out the way it did before, for ships of Kittim will come against him. Ships of Kittim are a reference to Cyprus, Cyprus most likely being a reference to the Roman army. He says the Roman army will come against Antiochus when he goes to attack the king of the south, and Antiochus will be defeated. He admits his defeat, verse 29. He will not turn out the way that it did before. He's not going to win this time. And so he turns away and returns to his own land again. But this time, he stops in Israel a second time. Look at verse 30. He will be disheartened. He just got beat in Egypt with the help of Rome. He will be disheartened and he will return and become enraged at the holy covenant, at God's people, at Israel. And he will take action so that he will come back and show regard for those who forsake the covenant. On his way from Egypt back to Syria, he is livid. He is enraged because he's been beaten in Egypt by the help of a Roman Empire and the forces. And he goes to the land of Israel on his way back to Syria and he commits all kinds of atrocities. Remember chapter 8 when we talked about the fact that Antiochus Epiphanes sacrificed a pig in the altar. Remember we talked about that? He spread the blood and the broth all over the temple. He forced pork down the throat of the priests. He put up an image of Zeus, the idol, in the temple. He caused what is called the abomination of desolation, and this is most likely when it occurred. On his way from Egypt back to Syria when he became enraged at the Holy Covenant. It happened on 16 December 167 BC. Verse 32, by smooth words he will turn to godlessness, those who act wickedly toward the covenant, but the people who know their God will display strength. Some godly Jews actually resisted him. We saw that in the Maccabean revolt. Verse 33 and 34, those who have insight among the people will give understanding to the many, yet they will fall by sword and by flame, by captivity and by plunder for many days. Now when they fall, they will be granted a little help and many will join them in hypocrisy. He's saying all this oppression is going to come against Israel. Verse 35, some of those who have insight will fall in order to refine, purge, and make them pure until the end time, because it is still to come at the appointed time. This is a description of all the persecution, all the oppression that Israel will have to endure. And friends, it goes all the way from Daniel to the time of the second coming of Jesus Christ, through the 70th week of Daniel, in the midst of the tribulation, when that other Antichrist comes. And we get to see him next week, starting in verse 36. My head hurts. What do you do with a text like this? Number one, there is a future for Israel. God is not done with Israel. There is still a future for them. They will be disciplined. Yes, in the tribulation, God will bring them to himself. But there is still a future for Israel. Number two, God's word is authoritative. God's word is trustworthy. And if you can prophesy something with this clarity and this precision, what does it tell us about the rest of the Word of God? It's trustworthy. It's reliable. It's dependable. Number three, the same God who wrote the history of the world is writing your history. He knows what's going on in your life. He knows every detail. He knows what's happening in your life, and none of it escapes him. Pray with me. Father, thank you so much for today. Lord, this is tough sledding. There's so many details and so many nuances and so many specifics here that, quite honestly, Father, we can't wrap our minds around it all. But suffice it to say, Lord, you are sovereign. You are in control, and you are working every detail of human history to the end which you've already ordained for our good and for your glory. Thank you for this glimpse into this tremendous description of your greatness and your omniscience. It's in Christ's name we pray. Amen.